On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk facial recognition. It's front and center. It's with travelers as well as helping investigators find bad guys. It's also, could it possibly be a privacy violation? We talk browser security with our guest Danny Miller from Ericom Software and how their service might just revolutionize your surfing. Twiet on The Set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 249, recorded July 21st, 2017. The Isolation Chamber.
This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by the Amazon Aurora from AWS, a relational database engine that's compatible with MySQL and PostgreSQL, which provides up to 5 times the performance on the same hardware at a tenth of the cost. Check it out at aurora.aws.
Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of enterprise. But as you know, the world of enterprise is a pretty massive place. And in order to represent it correctly, I have to pull in another expert or another master in their domain, my co-host in crime, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of Advanced Network Computer Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, I hear you have a new toy down there, something from Form Labs?
Yeah, I've been playing around with the Form Labs 2 printer, and it's quite amazing. I've got to go and put an order in for some different resins. I want to try and play with the strong resin, which is supposed to be very nice and strong. I want to try and make some pressure housings with it, and then also the high temperature, which is good to 555 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty darn hot.
That's awesome. I might have to have you print something out for me because I need some high resolution stuff.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, cool. But thanks, guys. So as usual, we have some pretty interesting topics. We've talked a little bit about facial recognition today as well as how it applies to people who are traveling abroad. But we also have Ericom Software here to talk a little bit about browser security. But first, like we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. Although they're not unheard of, hardware chip vulnerabilities are usually a few and far between when it comes to opening necessary security gaps for devices. Well, this past month, a pretty big vulnerability was found in Broadcom BCM4300 family of Wi-Fi chips. A researcher from Exodus Intelligence discovered a vulnerability coining Broadpwn, where it could allow proximate attacker to execute arbitrary code within the context of a kernel. It could also be triggered remotely without any user interaction. So essentially, when Wi-Fi packets are received by your device, even on a hardened OS, a separate chip parses all the Wi-Fi packets and runs with it, runs the code and the bytes, sometimes with no exploit mitigations at all. How broad has the reach of the vulnerability? Well, it's particularly vulnerable, and it reaches across both iOS and Android devices alike. Google began patching the weakness back in the beginning of July, calling it a severe vulnerability and issuing a patch that wasn't, but it wasn't actually clear how broad the impact was going, even across Apple iOS devices at that time. On July 19th, it became clear that that is actually really severe vulnerability, as it also affected iOS devices as Apple issued a critical security update. In addition to that patch, Broadpwn vulnerability, Apple addressed 13 other arbitrary execution vulnerabilities tied to everything from a buffer overflow bug found in Contacts app, memory corruption in the core audio component, as well as others. If anything we learned by this continually surface of exploits is you better keep your OS and apps up to date.
We've all heard of Uber. Well, Roadie is an app-based shipping community that was founded on the Southern hospitality notion of neighbors helping neighbors. The idea struck founder Mark Gorlin one day when he needed a couple of boxes of custom tile from a warehouse a few hours away to finish his bathroom renovation and had no economical or practical way of getting them the same day. You start to think, there's always someone somewhere, surely someone who is already headed in that direction would be willing to transport a couple of boxes of tiles for him. A light bulb went off and Roadie was born. By tapping into the more than 1 billion square feet of excess capacity in passenger vehicles already on the road, Roadie is bringing disruptive innovation to the $90 billion shipping industry. The service connects people with stuff to send with drivers heading in the right direction. Roadie's model enables efficient, low-cost delivery for senders and rewards drivers for trips they're already taking. Both the sender and receiver can track deliveries in real time via smartphone, and goods are automatically protected up to $500 with the option to purchase additional coverage up to $10,000. Roadie partners with UPS Capital for this additional protection, providing another level of comfort to senders. Pricing is determined by distance and urgency. In addition to size, most local gigs will cost between $8 and $50, and long-distance gigs with oversized items can cost maybe $650, and just a bit more for pets.
So if you were fed 800,000 images of food, could you also spit out the recipe of them too? Well, MIT felt that it was a valuable feat to conquer using a bit of artificial intelligence. The neural learning program, coined Recipe 1M, is a way researchers can prove out how complex judgments can be made by just looking at a picture. Scientists fed the system over 800,000 images of food and over a million recipes by scraping well-known sites. By providing the system with such a massive amount of training data, scientists were able to properly educate the system. What's the vision of the system? Well, imagine where you could take a picture of your food and all the common nutrition information is sent to you, as well how to make the meal even healthier. Back in 2014, Swiss researchers actually developed a mathematical model called Food 101, which it could actually identify type of food correctly about 50% of the time. This model became even more accurate with the more information that it was sent and the more broad data that was sent. How accurate is Recipe 1M? Well, it actually got the recipe right 70% of the time. That's not bad. What did it struggle on? Well, the AI struggled with more ambitious or ambiguous foods, such as sushi and smoothies. I can't help but think about the TV show Silicon Valley character Jin Yang and his seafood app, and how it had a bit of potential influence on such a development of this tech.
Oh, yes, I did just pop a Ricola. Rackspace makes a deal to go spelunking into big data to help mitigate cyber threats. While this is being described as a deal and not a merger or acquisition, this is a big enough deal to make technology headlines. The deal would provide Rackspace with access to the Splunk machine learning systems to better utilize the nearly 3 terabytes of daily usage data from the hosting giant. Rackspace security and compliance divisions expect the ability to detect unauthorized users inside a client's network to increase by 70% and slice the financial ding from outages in half. Rackspace security analysis will use Splunk inside its Security Operations Center, also known as a SOC, to monitor thousands of computer network endpoints that include servers, network devices, and cyber threat feeds. What is clear is that Rackspace wanted help separating the trees from the forest in a deluge of operational data generated in their hosting and cloud operation centers. The Interop team has been using Splunk for decades now, and over the years have been finding more and more ways to go beyond traditional syslog data.
We all have a bit of data and speeds issues nowadays, and we have had that discussion going on constantly because of net neutrality. Well, it seems that Verizon is giving us a reason to be sensitive. It was found that Verizon Wireless customers have been continuously throttled when it comes to watching, viewing, and Netflix. Where did this all start? Well, users started complaining online while using the fast.com speed test, which is actually hosted by Netflix, where users stated they were only getting a max of maybe 10 megabits per second, but even in a high integrity signal area, the range was referencing around 5 megabits per second to about 10 megabits per second, even though the typical web speeds they were getting in that same area was 40 megabits. We've heard about this before when Netflix had put a limit on connection speeds for AT&T and Verizon smartphone users, but this time Netflix is saying it's not them. Some providers such as T-Mobile claim that their solutions are optimizing things, and it's an optimization mechanism rather than compressing a model and throttling mechanism. This then sparks that greater thought that without some sort of regulation here, ISPs and mobile service providers will find more creative ways to optimize profit and network scalability, sometimes compromising quality and reliability without customers actually knowing. Now is the time for action, if there's ever been one.
Microsoft wants to connect 2 million rural Americans to high-speed wireless broadband by 2022, and it will get started with 12 pilot projects over the next year. The company is also offering free access to its intellectual property to help the rest of rural America get connected. Microsoft isn't planning to become an internet service provider itself. Instead, the company will invest in partnerships with telecommunications companies, building wireless networks using TV white spaces spectrum. Microsoft President Brad Smith wrote in a blog post the other day, "We and our partners will have at least 12 projects up and running in 12 states in the next 12 months. White space refers to the frequency spectrum gap between TV channels, and the FCC has laid out rules in 2010 for the use of the white space for unlicensed wireless use. What this would provide is approximately 25 megabits per second download and 3 megabits per second upload speeds for approximately 23.4 million underserved rural users in America."
So if there was going to be a massive social network for shopping, it might as well come from one of the largest retailers online, right? Well, Amazon has launched a social feature to the site called Spark. What does it do? Well, it allows members to showcase products via sharing photos and videos and then actually purchase the products. Users essentially can tag product content they find and anyone browsing the feeds on the network and instantly find metadata about the products, allowing them to purchase it. Starting to sound a bit familiar to Pinterest and Instagram with a little bit more retail focus, well, part of the business plan here was to have users promote more products outside of just reviews, giving it essentially a direct avenue to purchase those products and have it the next day. But another angle of this business is also to invite publishers, including paid influencers and bloggers, to post on Spark. Of course, they're going to be identified with a sponsored hashtag. This looks to be the entrance of Amazon directly into the paid advertising space outside their retail product pages. Seeing that Amazon has a good portion of the market, this could create a massive influx of additional revenue streams for the corporation. It might be time to purchase some Amazon stock. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to get into the bites, where we talk a little bit about facial recognition. But first, we couldn't do This Week in Enterprise Tech without our fabulous sponsors. And Leo wants to tell you about one. Leo?
Gentlemen, if I might interrupt for just a moment, I want to mention our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. If you're an enterprise tech, I think you'll know the name. It's a little company out of Seattle, Washington, called Amazon Web Services. Yeah, you've heard of them. But have you heard about Amazon Aurora? Ooh, I love it. Amazon Aurora is a relational database engine completely compatible with MySQL or PostgreSQL, but five times the performance of standard MySQL on the same hardware. To build the kinds of things developers want to build today, you need great tools, super tools like a database that grows as your business grows and is easy to manage. That's Amazon Aurora. Can scale up to millions of transactions a minute. Automatically grow your storage up to 64 terabytes if you need it. You can replicate so you never lose data. Replicate six copies of your data to three different availability zones. Gotta love that. Tolerates failure, even automatically fixes failures, and continually backs up your data at Amazon S3. This is what you're looking for, Amazon Aurora. And Amazon RDS fully manages it all, so you don't have to. If you're already using Amazon RDS for MySQL, a couple of clicks and you're migrated to Amazon Aurora. So, what you're getting, let me recap. Five times better performance than MySQL. Security, availability, and reliability of a commercial database. Oh, did I say at a tenth the cost? No upfront charges, no commitments. You only pay for what you use. Amazon Aurora. You can check it out at Aurora, A-U-R-O-R-A, A-U-R-O-R-A dot A-W-S. And start imagining what you can build with Amazon Aurora from AWS. A-U-R-O-R-A dot A-W-S. And we're so glad to have Amazon Web Services on as a partner for This Week in Enterprise Tech. Great company, great product. And now we take you back to Twyatt.
Thanks, Leo. And thanks to Amazon AWS for their support. Well, folks, let's jump into the bites. And so how would you feel if not only your X-rayed your body, but they also took a picture of your face when you were flying abroad? Well, the Department of Homeland Security said it's the only way to successfully expand a program that tracks non-immigrant foreigners. what has been done in the past? Well, if you've traveled abroad, you know that you've had to submit some kind of biometric-based identifiable claim, such as fingerprints, photos, which are collected before you make your trip. But what is this new program? Well, it's to scan departures from the country to essentially track visa overstays and also tighten security. But that they won't be actually keeping photos of U.S. citizens? Well, the Electronic Privacy Information Center is a bit worried here. Not only do they think that there could be potential government abuse, but also that there could be sensitive data here, and it potentially could be vulnerable to hackers as well. This is actually supposed to cost over $1 billion to implement, but the DHS is looking to subsidize some of the costs by partnerships with the airlines themselves. I don't know. What do you think, Cheaper? Is this moving us a little bit closer to the Big Brother future, where the government gains even more leverage with our digital face prints as well?
Yeah, quite possibly. Now, keep in mind, this is actually a 3D facial scan. So it's actually getting more details than just a flat image. So this is going beyond just the surveillance cameras that they've been using already. Now, the idea behind this was simply they're trying to get a handle on the people that are abusing the visa system, you know, basically the tourist and student visa system. And, you know, that sounds great. But if DHS is going to be holding on to this, now they said, oh, we're only going to hang on to it for 14 days. Yeah, well, that's right now. What happens with a little later? I personally don't object too much if it's only, say, 14 days. But when someone decides to start hanging on to these and hanging on to these and hanging on to these for a long time and start maybe feeding it into the NSA, that starts getting into be some serious privacy issues. So I think it was a good idea to start, and I think, unfortunately, big government is going to be abusing it. So I don't like it.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting part is the interesting part that they were saying is that, you know, you can't opt out. So there's no way to say, hey, I'm a U.S. citizen. I have rights. You can't take my picture. They basically say, sorry, then you can't travel. But the interesting part is they're saying, but we don't really care about the U.S. citizens. We really care about the fact that these are potential international travelers or visa holders. So if you can prove that you're a U.S. citizen, why can't you opt out of the photo? Cheaper, what do you think?
One can only hope. But I think one of the problems is you start getting into, okay, is that a real passport? Is it a fake passport? Do we have checks and balances? The unfortunate fact of life is there's a booming industry overseas of people with faking passports or stealing passports so they have legitimate numbers and then modifying it with the pictures. It's troublesome. You know, there's an awful lot of data when you have a 3D print. And, I don't know. I don't think I like this. Not one bit. Sam.
I think so. So the interesting part, though, here is, you know, you obviously said it, the difference here is this 3D print. It's a 3D picture, right? So it's providing a little bit more fidelity than the normal, like, flat 2D picture that you can get off, you know, somebody's social network or so on. But, you know, kind of the flip side here is they kind of already have some biometric information about you. They already have your license photo. They already have your passport photo. You know, they can pretty much do whatever they want with this information at this point. So the interesting part is, I guess, adding a little bit more fidelity to it, how is that? I guess the question back is, how is it any different than already using the stream of data that they already have?
Well, I'm actually not going to express my personal opinion. I'm going to just read an opinion from a biometrics consultant and former DHS analyst named Ben Ball. He's saying the government hasn't yet addressed the thorniest question. This is still a theoretical system, and that we are the first country on Earth to attempt a comprehensive biometric system, and it's very technically complicated. Gee, what can possibly go wrong, right?
So the interesting part here is that, you know, I think, you know, the TSA kind of already collects data, right? So, I mean, if you're a part of TSA PreCheck, you essentially give, you know, additional biographical information. You give your digital fingerprint. You already provide a whole bunch of additional information in order to just kind of speed up the process to get through airport security. So is this just – I mean, to me, it's almost like just an additional touch point, an additional data point for them to ensure that you're really saying who you are. You know, I guess you, if you're already providing a fingerprint, though, what do they – I guess I still don't get why they need this additional piece of data if they already have this, right?
Well, you know, fingerprints, we've known fingerprints to be able to be faked. But I think I think what they're trying to get, this is just my opinion now, is, gee, you might be able to fake a fingerprint or maybe a couple fingerprints, but can you fake fingerprints and a 3D facial scan? Because the 3D would allow you to get past the modifications, to get the facial geometry so that facial recognition can get past things like fake noses or extra thick eyebrows or maybe a buildup of a chin. That's what the 3D is really all about. And, you know, it sounds good, and I do like the concept of additional security, but is it really going to work? You know, have we actually talked to the experts enough? Have we tried things out on a smaller scale? It's $1 billion is an awful lot of money to spend on something that may or may not work. And this is, you know, should we really be the first? Shouldn't it be maybe on a smaller scale? You know, Danny's listening in Tel Aviv, and I tell you, I have never felt more safe than in Ben Gurion Airport. You know, so maybe the United States needs to go and take a lot more cues from our Israeli friends.
Right, exactly. So this is interesting because this kind of leads us into the next discussion, the next bite, where we're a bit worried about our privacy and where our data goes. But what if it actually can help and make us more secure, like you were just saying? So facial recognition is not just something that the IMF is using for Mission Impossible or something that Facebook is using for tagging your silly photos. Is it different? Well, what if the country could make safe, and particularly in this particular Ars article, it puts it as, we often speak of facial recognition technology as some Orwellian surveillance method that will one day be deployed by governments or other actors to chronicle our every move and perhaps for nefarious purposes. But using facial recognition for good is not a crazy notion, right, Chibert? Well, I think Nevada authorities don't think so either, saying that they have announced that biometrics was one of the reasons they were able to arrest a violent criminal who actually escaped prison over 25 years ago. It just adds to the string of arrests that were possible due to biometrics. 64-year-old criminal Robert Frederick Nelson of North Las Vegas escaped from Minnesota prison in 1992. But when he went to go apply for a Nevada ID card, the Silver State's facial recognition system threw up some red flags. T-Bert, so it says that over 50% of adults today have their images in a crime-fighting or biometric database somewhere. Should they also be able to use it for things like this? We're essentially not just pulling you over from a cop perspective. Is it should be using it for, hey, is this person bad no matter when they identify you, when you need to do something from a government perspective?
You know, they talk about the long arm of the law, and my personal opinion is the long arm of the law actually does need to get a little bit longer. When we have felons that can escape incarceration for crimes that they've done for 25 years, you know, that shouldn't have happened. And I like the fact that we're using technology to go and help close in on these people. There are a lot of unsolved cases, and there's a lot of people that are on the lam. Let's go ahead and close that up a little bit. I personally think this is a good use of facial recognition, and you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing to actually have, say, facial recognition running behind, say, the police body cams, so that if we have a person that's pulled over that's a violent felon that's just got a broken taillight, I think it would be nice for us to be able to tell that police officer that they have potentially a violent felon, please exercise caution.
Right. Yeah, I think that's it. I think you and I can both agree that I think it's actually a pretty good use of this data, especially if they're making our streets safe and our communities safer. But I think the interesting part is I'm not a lawyer, but kind of the flip side of things is if they're taking your picture, especially in a public scene, you know, there's essentially meaning that if somebody gets their picture taken in public, it's not necessarily considered private. So they could be essentially used for anything. It could be posted online. It could be used for anything. So it'd be interesting to get a lawyer's perspective on this, because just as Facebook kind of uses their AI to identify you, I guess the question would be back is it against the law for the government to use it to ID you as well? So I think, Cheaper, what do you think? I think this is kind of making it super confusing for technology, right? So what is the fair use of it and what's not? When can it be used for that? When can it not? When it can it? It's a government issue versus a private corporation issue. I think is it time for us to start nailing down some regulations here maybe?
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking the same thing. You know, Gravitas in the chat room said, if you're in public, no expectation of privacy at all. And Emily Strange mentions we need Denise Hall. Yeah, I agree. We actually really do need to start setting some guidelines, because otherwise, you know, if I'm a law enforcement agent of any sort and I am desperately trying to go and track down that bank robber that shot someone on the way out, I'm going to be, shall we say, enthusiastic about using any tool at my disposal to try and apprehend those people. Now, if there are no clear-cut guidelines, then maybe the tools get abused. So, yeah, I'm thinking maybe it's time to actually have people like the ACLU, the American Legal Society, you know, people like that, to actually sit down and say, hey, what really is the bright blue line in the sand? Let's go and define that. Let's not have a fuzzy line. Let's have a bright blue line so that we can have some guidelines within American law enforcement on how far you can go that is considered acceptable. And let's live with it.
Right. Yeah, I think the interesting part is, like, according to the Gravitas, obviously, if you're in public and somebody takes your picture, there's no, privacy, right? So there's no expectation of privacy. But there is a kind of a flip side of that is, you know, there is some scenarios where there is an expectation of privacy, such as, like, you know, when you're typing in your ATM PIN or something in public, that's considered an expectation of privacy. But if you're just walking around, you know, taking your picture, it's not illegal, right, at this point. And unless, you know, the law at some point tells you it's not, I don't think neither the Patriot Act nor the Homeland Security Act have any provisions around restricting photography in public and any person. But, you know, the interesting part of this is if somebody's taking your picture and they're using it for other purposes, what, you know, is it become a thing of privacy? Does it need to be identified as a thing of privacy? Because they're using your data for another purpose to make something better, to make something worse, to identify something else. So again, I don't know if it's something that needs to be some new arbitrary law that comes out to kind of identify this thing, or if it's more about, hey, you just need to have a reasonable expectation that you're in public, this data is going to be readily available, somebody's going to take your picture, whether it's in a public scenery setting or not, and that might be used. Like, for instance, there's a lot of private systems out there today that are crowdsourcing data based off of crowds and other things. You know, what's your sentiment information, and, you know, are you harmful or not harmful? You know, how do you like a product? How do you not like a product? And they're using all this information coming from public domain information. So I think, you know, does it mean we need to have to start regulation? I'm guessing potentially when some new technology comes out, we're going to need some more. What do you think?
Who knows? The technology is racing ahead so fast that regulations and laws and just common sense aren't always keeping up. You know, just the fact that there's a trial project with Delta Airlines and TSA where you don't need a paper or even a boarding pass on your cell phone. All you need are your fingerprints and go right onto the plane. You know, that means someone's storing their fingerprints. In this case, it's Clear, which I happen to be a member of. And I like having some way to positively identify myself. But yeah, I do acknowledge that they are taking some extreme efforts to protect the private information, in this case, my biometrics and background information they use for the ClearPass. And I'd like people that are doing such things to have the same level of care, shall we say, you know, care and consideration of my privacy. And if people, everybody did that, then, you know, maybe this wouldn't be such a big deal. But I'm seeing so many things that could potentially be abused and people with a very cavalier attitude. And that's, I think, is the danger. And that, I think, is going to cause regulations to be forthcoming.
Right, right. Well, hopefully things will become a little bit more clear as history goes and moves on. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites, but now we get to move into my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest who gets to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot, and today is no exception. In today's connected world, there's a constant talk about how secure browsers are on the internet, and some say locking your system down or even hardening your system is just not enough. Well, we have Danny Miller, Director of Product Marketing for Ericom Software, with us today to talk a little bit about some of the options for the enterprise. Welcome, Danny. Welcome to Twilight. Can you tell the folks at home a little bit about Ericom Software?
Great. Thanks for having me. Okay, Ericom Software. Let me introduce the company. We are a software house. We've been in the business for more than 20 years. The company grew from doing secure remote access, virtualization, and in other type of remote type of security solution, entering into the cyberspace, the cyber world, and we're now about to launch a very exciting secure browsing solution based on isolation technologies, and this is what I'd like to talk about today.
Great. So why don't you tell a little bit about just tell us about the solution, what Ericom Shield is. You know, what problem is it trying to solve, and how does it solve it?
Right. So when we're looking at the reality in the corporate world, we see that there are many attack vectors that are impacting the organization. Attack vector meaning that we can see that exploits are coming into the organization through different area. However, when you're looking at the browsing, it turns out that the browser is probably the weakest link in terms of the corporate environment. And there are various research pieces that showed that indeed the browser are the most, I would say, most prevalent attack vectors, more than any other else. So I would say browsers and probably emails. Here you actually see we have a new guy called Joe Ciso, who's kind of trying to deal with that problem, because when we come and look at what the organizations are doing, they're really investing a lot of money and effort in building a pile of product that doing detection and prevention. And as we all know, and you guys already touched upon it, detection and prevention is great as long as you keep things you know, up to date. But the patching is kind of impossible, right? So when you're thinking about ransomware and other and phishing attacks and all kind of social engineering possibilities, you realize that doing the patching is one thing, but the whole concept of doing, again, detection prevention using signature type solutions is just not good enough. And even when you start looking at solutions that are, for example, next generation antiviruses, and secure web gateway and email filtering and all those great products, you know, even when you have all those together in a defense in-depth strategy, still it's not enough. So what we're actually bringing to the table is a new concept. It's I'd say it's a kind of a paradigm shift saying, look, we believe that we are unable to really differentiate between good and bad. It's just impossible to say what kind of content that is coming through browsing, which website are actually can bring some exploits and can be malicious. So instead of doing the process of saying this is good or this is bad and making some mistakes that caused the organization a lot of money and a lot of effort, we actually say we don't know what's good or what's bad. And as a result, we're just going to isolate everything. And by isolating it, it means that we're going to enable the user's normal browsing, native browsing experience. However, this browsing is going to be done through a virtual browser that resides outside the corporate environment. So it resides in the DMZ. So when you come to think of it, what you're actually doing is you have a virtual browser that in a remote location doing all the heavy lifting for you, doing all the browsing. And what the user is receiving is actually receiving a stream, a flow of images. So nothing is coming onto the user endpoint because these are just images. So there's no JavaScript, there's no malvertising, there's nothing that's coming through the browsing session, but still the user can act normally, browse whatever browsing they whatever website they wanna visit without jeopardizing the enterprise. Does it make sense?
Yeah. So I have a couple of questions. So I think so. You talk about a little bit about how it's done in kind of a DMZ zone. How is this different than maybe some like a VDI type thing where you're don't actually running the application on your machine? So like for instance, virtualizing, a browser in that case. How does this kind of differ from that?
Right. So when you look at some of the solutions to do secure browsing. I mean, obviously, we have those solutions that try to do some hardening, and we know of some government and even some banks who are doing a totally separation between the networks, which we all know it's just, too expensive, and it's not realistic to keep it ongoing. So there are some other type of solutions who are basing on putting a virtual browser somewhere, for example, using a Microsoft RDS technology, using a terminal services, or even solutions that are doing local isolation on the endpoint. However, the way we see the world is we believe that everything should happen away from the user and away from the local area network. So when you actually have that virtual browser, it's not just a virtual browser, it's actually a container because we're talking about isolation. So it is a container. In this container, we run a Linux operating system and a virtual browser that's doing all the browsing. By using Linux, you actually get a lot of, security by design. And there are, of course, other types of security measures and hardening that we do within the system. So it is not exactly the same.
So you say you kind of server render and acquire all the third-party resources that maybe a page might have, and you kind of do that in a container-wise. How does this potentially – does it ever compromise any of the data that's on the actual page itself? Does it strip everything from the site? Can the user view the content in the site still after it's kind of get down to the machine? How does it kind of set that up?
Okay. So actually, the great thing about the solution – is that the user doesn't even know they're browsing through a virtual browser. The way the solution is set up is that it passes through the proxy. So we actually hook up into the existing proxy using an ICAP protocol. And what we do is we kind of inherit the policies that are existing in the organization. What I mean by that is, let's say you have a certain site who has been whitelisted and no problem. Let's say it's the organization CRM. You actually don't need the virtual browser in this case because you go directly there. But let's say you have a site that hasn't been defined as either a whitelisted or blacklisted. Let's say you just go to CNN. If you actually go right now to CNN and check the source of the page, you're going to probably see between 3,000 to 4,000 lines of code. And this lines of code full of JavaScript and malvertising and a lot of third-party URLs that may be actually trying to penetrate your organization. When you're actually using the virtual browser, the only code that you're going to see when you're going to look at the source of the page is about 6 lines of code calling the rendering engine. Okay, what it means is that nothing is actually reaching the endpoint. Now, all this is not worth the effort if the user is going to say, I have a crap user experience. But the reality is that the user doesn't even know that a second ago or in a certain tab, they're actually watching a certain website. It's been whitelisted and they go directly. And then on another tab, they actually going through a virtual browser. Actually, what's interesting to also note is that for every tab that the user opens, we actually generate a dedicated virtual browser. So the security is really inherent in the session. And once the session is over or it's time out, this container is going to be discarded, right? It's actually going to explode, going to disappear, and any potential malware that may have been there is now gone.
So, you know, it's interesting. You can tell when a topic is really great because the chat room is just blowing up with questions. I think one of the questions they have is, you know, you talk a little bit about how this is virtualizing a browser, containing this particular tab that you're on. But they have questions a lot about, like, it seems like almost like a man in the middle type thing where you're kind of taking data from the site, could be a secured site with secured data on it, and then you're containerizing it, you're doing some stuff to it, and then you're streaming it down to the user after it's been kind of scanned and removed any threats. Is there any compliance here? Like, if there's any HIPAA compliant here, like how are you securing that data so it doesn't leak to others, some of these other processes, that kind of thing?
Okay, so let me first clarify. What we're doing with the data is we are not manipulating the page. We are not, I mean, there are some other players in the market who are actually stripping down the page and recreating the page in a, I would say, a non-malicious or flattening the page. So they're trying to imitate the situation so the page look normal. We don't do that. We actually doing real-time rendering of the page, and it goes directly from the container or the pool of containers and streaming into the endpoint. So there's actually nothing in the middle because you can totally control the flow of the network, right? Because I understand the question that you're thinking maybe there is a man in the middle here, but actually there's nothing because you're going directly from, you know, your virtualized container, your virtual browser, and streaming it specifically into the user. So we create that handshake with the user.
So you're saying you're not actually storing any state. You're just real time rendering it and streaming it to the user, so that they can whatever this page is supposed to look like and operate like, they see that and they can still interact with the page as if it was solely rendered on their machine.
So the page looks and behaves like a normal page. They wouldn't know the difference. So everything works, all the clicks, all the hovering, scrolling, everything behaves normally. If you want to click on a video and watch a video, you watch the video, there's audio, you can do copy paste, everything, you can print, everything is normal. The challenge here is really to go and create an environment and a situation that the user doesn't really feel the difference. Now, something may be very complex and then people don't expect, but browsing is something very common. Everyone is browsing, so everyone knows what the browsing experience is. And unless it's going to be, down perfect, then the solution is just not going to be good enough. So the whole effort here is to make sure that, you know, you create the situation that the user would not notice. Now, right. One thing that I'd like to mention, which I think is very important, is around deployment. And I don't know if this is one of the questions coming, but I think it's very important to highlight. One of the great benefits of having some sort of a solution is, okay, I can deploy it across a wide enterprise, but now you're going to ask, so what am I going to deploy on the endpoint and how do I deal with BYOD? Because corporations today are just full of different devices. And the beauty here is that we are using HTML5. Actually, the company was one of the first one to develop a clientless solution based on HTML5 already in 2011. So we got tens of thousands of devices already using our technology, and we're actually taking advantage of our heritage. And this is 100% clientless solution. That means that if you're now using Chrome on iPad, or if you're using Explorer on your PC, it doesn't really matter. If it's HTML5 type browser, then we know what to do with it. So if you think about what the IT administrator need to do, what they really need to do is they need to route the traffic through the proxy and make sure that if the website, the URL that the user is trying to access is not defined as an approved or blocked website, they need to make sure it goes into the Ericom Shield and open up the virtual browser. But from the end user perspective, it's totally transparent experience.
Right. So you kind of go back to it real quick. I mean, you kind of said something a little bit that was interesting to me, and the chat room's actually asking, you know, Emily, the Strange and Specs and Digimac Max is, for instance, how does it handle latencies? For instance, how does it set up where, you know, if a video is coming in or, you know, a large image or that kind of thing, how does that kind of latency handled if you have to be able to have this kind of proxying mechanism in between?
Right. So as I mentioned, I mean, latency is part of the game, but we limited to the bare minimum. And with images, you have really no latency that you can observe in using the naked eye. And then videos, we've done a lot of work on making sure that the video is accelerated. And again, if you happen to be, you know, in Europe and you're actually using a proxy, which is in the US, and you're now going to a site somewhere, I don't know, then you may notice some latency. But at the end of the day, if you have a decent connectivity, we will deal with the latency to the bare minimum. And as I said, it's all about user experience. If we can't have a good user experience, that people are just not going to use it. And we deal with it.
Right. It's another question, kind of similar to that, is what if you're like a user and you're downloading, you know, some content, whether you're downloading documents or images or something like that, we're actually downloading content. You're not actually rendering it in the page. How does this kind of solution handle that as well?
Right. Great question. Because again, this is part of the user experience, and that we know that for a complete experience, people sometimes need to download stuff from the internet. Now, I can tell you that I've been to a couple of financial organizations recently, and they said, well, we don't care. We don't let people download stuff. But let's put it aside, because I think this is part of the package. So first of all, what we see in the field is that there are a lot of customers who actually have sanitization systems. So these are kind of a whitening type of servers with third-party software who are able to do file sanitization and enable download files. And we are able to connect to these using, you know, standard API. However, for those organizations who do not have that kind of a solution in place, we actually, as part of our solution, we have a third-party solution embedded in our product, in Ericom Shield, and we enable this downloading of files. How it's being done? Let's remember that for every browsing session, you have a dedicated container. So if you're browsing using that session now, we're actually downloading the file into that disposal container. We run those whitening sanitization packages, which are actually combined of two different types of products. One is multi-scanning technology using just a lot of antivirus engines. And the other one is CDR, content disarm and reconstruction, which actually takes apart the file, flatten it, get rid of any potential malware, and bringing it back to a usable format using the original template as provided by the manufacturer, let's say a Microsoft Word or Microsoft PowerPoint. So these third-party engines are actually able to dissect and rebuild the files so they're completely reusable. And on top of this, we do the multi-scanning. And only after the process has been done and the file is safe to use, only then it's being downloaded to the endpoint. So all this process is actually happening in a safe zone, in isolation, where the user is not being impacted. And if there's any potential malware in this file and it's been detected, then the user is just going to get a message saying, hey, this file is malicious or there is a threat and you won't be able to get this file today, which I believe is an okay answer for this user.
Right. So it sounds like you have kind of almost like a curated workflow on in this isolation for especially when you're downloading files, especially of a specific type. Is it customizable by an implementer where they say, hey, I have a particular file type that your server might not know how to deconstruct and reconstruct? Can I add additional third-party software to that to be able to do that? Is it extensible?
Right. So as I said, what we're using I would say best practice in the industry. This is the type of solution we've embedded in our product, and we can share, you know, the list of files, which is I would say very extensive list of files. I would say you would find the most of what you expect from all the Microsoft suite and Adobe and all that. And if there are any particular file that is needed, we can always go back to to those vendors and check. And as I said, if you already have in place or you want to acquire on your own a third-party whitening type of sanitization solution, have it in-house, then we can just simply connect using an API, connect and have your process. Some organizations actually have cloud folders that they're using to test those files and clean them up. So again, we can connect to any of these processes and enable it, no problem.
Right. So you talked a little bit about how, you know, the site itself gets rendered and it's kind of in isolation, its own container, it's on the server, it's virtualized. Is there any other, you said you did a little antivirus scanning, you do some other things. Is there any other type of analysis you do of the site? Like, for instance, maybe some phishing analysis, like where, for instance, a user might be routed to like a third party login that looks like a real login, but it's not. Does the service provide a way to tell a user they're in a bad space, in a bad spot? Or is it more around the content within the site?
Right. So actually, I think it's almost a philosophical question. And I said it before, and I'd like to make this point clearer. When I talk about right and wrong, I think this is probably the main difference between the current products in the market and the type of isolation approach. We just don't claim to say, hey, this may be a phishing site or not. We just say, this is a URL that you just received an email that looks legitimate, and you just clicked on this email. Based on your organizational policy, if this URL has not been either whitelisted or blacklisted, it will, by default, will open using a virtual browser. So if this has been a phishing attempt, it's only going to work within that virtual container, and it's not going to get anywhere. So the concept is you can't really say this is a good site or this is a potential phishing attempt. And we all know that the human factor, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much education we're going to do in the organization and how high is the person, in terms of the actual food chain in the organization, people just sometimes click on the wrong link. And it happens. It happens to everyone. And the concept of the Ericom Shield isolation is that we don't care. We just going to open it in a virtual browser away and making sure that nothing gets to your endpoint. And I think this is the beauty of the solution. This is why it's protecting the enterprise from that user through doing the extra click.
Right. So I think it was Gartner. They kind of called out several kind of what they call lean forward programs that essentially organizations should be focusing on to make sure that they're kind of isolating risky applications and ensure that they're it's kind of taken away from their core endpoint resources. They call out several kind of, I'd say, pillars of containment or solutions for that. Like, for instance, application containment, remote application isolation, virtualization, other VDI technologies. Where do you feel like the Aircom solutions kind of fit in there? Is across kind of a couple of those or just one of those?
Right. So actually, just to note on that, Gartner, and I happened to attend the Gartner Security Summit in Washington a couple of weeks back. They actually mentioned isolation as one of the they had a session about what are the hot topics in security, and isolation was actually number two in those topics. So definitely, Gartner is looking at isolation as something that's gonna grow and it's gonna impact how security is gonna be consumed in the enterprise. Now, when you look at the Aircom Shield solution specifically to your question, again, we can handle application. Again, they need to be like a cloud application, web application, and we are really focusing on the browser as the the main attack vector where things are coming from. I want to allude to something else regarding isolation. As a company, we actually, before we embarked on that very exciting project, we actually ran a little survey. And out of nowhere, we just sent a Survey Monkey to a list of top security senior executives in North America and in Europe. And we were amazed to actually get a response from dozens and dozens, close to 100 people, really ranked very, very high in Fortune 500 companies. And all of them said, you know, we understand that. We believe that this is a solution. This is an approach that is really needed. And not only that, we understand the fact that browsing is not a luxury anymore. We can't really say to employees, stop browsing, because they need to, as you just mentioned, access those business application, being it Salesforce or others, in order to do their job. And they need to do research on, you know, on financial topics. And they want to do competitive analysis. And so these kind of things have been solidifying the concept that isolation can provide that avenue, that safe avenue for corporate employees to use the browser to do their work and still keep the organization safe.
Right. So we're still got a ton of questions kind of coming in. One of them actually is around kind of customization. So you talked a little bit about before how some organizations might have a setup of whitelists, or they have other things where they essentially set up a set of what I guess you can call them policies, where they, you know, they handle what can come in and what can come out. How does this Shield system, you said it kind of takes on, you know, there are already lists and their settings, but how does it kind of regulate? Well, let's say I didn't want to actually run this particular site through this particular system, or maybe I didn't want some sensitive data that I didn't want to kind of run through there, or I know it's from a trusted source. Can I regulate that? Is it role centric? Is it user centric? Is it policy based? How do you kind of customize the system?
Okay. So obviously, we want to keep things as simple as possible, but things are not as simple as you want it to be. So first of all, there are usually more than one components in the network. I mean, you might actually go through a firewall, and then you may actually have a secure web gateway and maybe a secure email gateway. So we need to be able to also not only work along the lines with all those components and create that defense in depth, but we also have a web admin that helps you not only take the existing policies, but also make some changes based on, as you said, maybe a particular site is actually whitelisted, but I want to make sure that people access it, you know, a certain way, or I want to limit it for a certain group, or I want to limit it per role. So obviously, you can create those specific customization. So you can really go the full width of the solution. You can either just take your existing policy and run with it, or you can go and customize very specific types of, from a specific website to a group of website, and everything in between.
Right.
And it's much needed because obviously this is part of what organization need. It's not a cookie cutter solution, even though they may have, you know, collected that blacklist for years. Still, they want to do some tweaks, and we enable this, of course.
So, what kind of audience are you targeting here? Are you targeting solely just the enterprise and large organizations, or are you targeting? Can consumers use this? Can maybe EDUs or educational purposes? Can they use it? What's kind of the target here?
Right. So actually, the target is very broad. Something I failed to mention is that we actually have been developing this product based on our first generation secure browsing, which is based on RDS, on Microsoft technology. And we actually have dozens of customers already using it. And they are ranging from, you know, financial to government to education. Now, when we are coming out with our second generation, which is really Ericom Shield, we approach different kinds of vertical. I mean, the financial, obviously, the healthcare, but also the education. We've just attended Campus Tech in Chicago, and there's a lot of interest, you know, in this, because universities. They have a lot of people roaming around with devices, and, you know, sometimes they just want to make sure that people adhere with a certain policy, and we can help them do that. So I can tell you that we're speaking to a large organization that has tens of thousands of users who are really looking at this as a lifesaver. And we also been speaking to some small organization who don't even have a proxy and counting on us to actually bring the proxy with it. So we can help them, you know, dissect the organization for little groups and make sure that we help them put policies. So what's nice about the solution is the range. It really is a very elastic, very dynamic type of solution. You can use as many servers as you want in order to increase your virtual browsing power. So as I said, you need you get a virtual browser per tab. So the more the merrier. You put more servers, and we will dynamically manage this to perfection to make sure that you know, whenever a user is needed this, whether it's a 10,000 user organization or 500, there will always be a browser ready for them to use.
Got it. So I think another question I had is, I tend to ask this to all service providers and so on. Can you just kind of walk us through the onboarding process? If I'm a small business and I want to get going, I want to be able to set up this proxy, how easy is it to get going? What do I have to do to kind of get started?
Right. So we talk and we understand your requirements, the type of the number of users and the type of setup. I mean, some organizations would like to have things deployed on-premise, and this is mandatory. Some organizations say, oh, no, we actually prefer to use the cloud. And some organizations are actually going to say, well, we want this on-premise, but we have a couple of remote offices where we actually prefer that they would be connected through the cloud. So we can actually deploy in all time, I mean, both on-premise, cloud, or in a hybrid setup. And then we evaluate your network components, and we together define where is the best place to install Shield. And usually this is the last component before the user actually access the outside world. The deployment itself, deployment is not sophisticated. Again, it's just an easy installation. And then we sit together and we work on configuration. As you asked before, it can either go vanilla and just inherit all your existing policies, or you actually may have some specific requirement and we need to spend some time together, or you can do it on your own. It's fairly straightforward. but still requires some configuration to make sure that both the component see each other, and then that the website that you wanted to have a special treatment are actually going to. When I say special treatment, I mean, for example, a certain website that you say, I don't want to allow copy paste, I don't want to allow clipboard from this, or I don't want to allow streaming from this. So again, so this is the type of things that you can go and define per site or per group or as discussed. And again, as I mentioned, this is a clientless solution, so you don't need to install anything. You don't need to deploy anything to the actual endpoints. It's all about routing the traffic to where the virtual browsers reside, which is usually in the DMZ or in the cloud. Right.
So Tinkertoy Tech actually had an interesting question. So what's kind of the costing structure? Is there a baseline cost like per seat or per user, or is it more of a customized solution based off of your needs and you kind of base it off of how many users, that kind of thing?
So pretty straightforward. This is a subscription-based solution per user, an annual subscription. It's, you know, if you we try to look at what's happening in the marketplace. Again, this is not replacing the AV, but I think organizations are kind of used to, you know, paying that subscription per, you know, an annual subscription. And this is the model that that we chose. We think it just simplifies the whole process. No need for customization. It's as I said, it's pretty straightforward in terms of that.
Now, there's another question. Chibert actually has a question, but he's hacking up some cough there. So he did have a question about how can you restrict, like, for instance, if you have a whole bunch of users in your system, like maybe 10 users, but you want to restrict this service to only a couple of them, maybe you don't have a license for them or whatnot. Is there a way to kind of authenticate the users so that you can restrict particular users using it versus not using it?
Okay. Right now, we are looking at identifying the users and specifically be able to manipulate per user. But then this is on the roadmap and will be coming soon. But right now, as is, we don't look at the specific ID. We just make sure that if the user is browsing through the network and is all the credential has been passed, then based on the proxy policy, we would enable that virtual browser when needed. So it's not particular restriction.
Got it. So I think Chibert's got this cough under control. Chibert, you had something to ask as well, right?
Yeah. It basically goes around, you know, when you get access to it, are we authenticating against an existing, say, Active Directory or an internal database? I guess the other question is, on the licenses, is it per potential user or is it per simultaneous user?
Okay. So first of all, in terms of the authentication, no need to further authenticate. Again, if you are able to normally access the internet through whatever credentials that you have, then you will be able to browse the internet, and we would only interfere if you're going into a site that hasn't been defined, and therefore it will be browsing through Shield. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is that the licensing is per user. So if you have a 500 people in the organization, you need licenses for all of them, we will take care of the, I would say, the browsing volume. As I said, in any given moment, there is a pool of browsers waiting for you. So you don't need to be wary that a user would want to go and browse and there's not going to be a browser. So we're not looking at counting how many concurrent browsers are using because, let's be honest, if we all just going to look at our computer right now, most likely you have at least 10 different tabs open. And 10 different tabs meaning 10 different virtual browsers. So there's no real way of saying what is a normal or a standard user. As a result, the subscription is per user, and regardless of how many browsers, how many tabs you're going to open, we will make sure it is handled.
Got it. So I guess one question for me is, so you kind of talked about this a little bit before, but I definitely have to ask. So there are some competitors in the space. For instance, you have Menlo Security, Spike, Siglu. But specifically, we've heard just recently about the acquisition of Fireglass by Symantec. And they claim what they call true isolation, where essentially they're, I think you said before, they're stripping source code and they're visually streaming kind of data to you. They're also streaming your documents, so they're not actually downloading directly your documents. Can you give them a little bit more specific how that Aircom and Shield is a little bit differentiator from this compared to something like a Fireglass?
Okay. So first of all, I think the acquisition of Fireglass is a very important message that the market is giving to the cyber community, saying isolation is the way to go. So we look at this very favorably, and we congratulate the people at Fireglass for a job well done. And we think this is the way to go. Maybe just to correct you, as far as I know, they are not stripping down the website. They are doing something very similar to what we do in terms of opening this in a virtual container and streaming the information. It's not stripping down the page. This is actually, to the best of my knowledge, something that Menlo Security is doing some manipulations to the page and reconstructing the page. Again, I don't want to misrepresent any of them. They are a competition, and I want to make sure I cite them correctly, but this is to the best of my knowledge. So in terms of technology, what Fireglass is doing is actually very similar to what Aircom is doing. I think the differentiation really is that as a company, our heritage is in the virtualization, secure remote access, and HTML5. And so we actually bringing forward all this experience and technology into our solution. So we feel that we're not bringing a new solution to the market, but rather a next generation of existing solution. And we are very confident in our ability to deliver a very solid user experience using isolation.
Right. Fantastic. So I did have one other quick question from the chat room. And Digimax was talking about how is this handled from, like, for instance, if you had multiple devices. So obviously people bring their own device to work. How does this differ? I know you talked a little bit about how it streams. Is it differ the technology between the device that you have? Is it the same technology? How does it kind of differ for devices?
Right. So as we all know, BYOD is here to stay. At the end of the day, the focus is HTML5. If you are using a device which is HTML5 supported, you're using a browser which is HTML5 supported, we can handle the user experience in the same fashion. As I said, it can be a Mac, it can be an Android device, or it can be a PC, and it doesn't matter. As long as you're using a browser which is HTML5, we will do the same trick over and over again, but you need to go through the corporate network. Otherwise, we can't control the trafficking of the, we can't route the traffic to the virtual browser. So that's, I would say, be the most important thing. If you are sitting in an internet cafe, what's it called, the Starbucks scenario, sorry for doing publicity here, but if you're sitting somewhere and just connecting to any Wi-Fi, unless you're going to be connecting to the corporate environment, we would not know how to route that traffic. If the organization has a device management policy, and these devices, regardless of where they are, always passing through the network infrastructure of the organization, then everything applies. We will do the routing based on the the existing policy, and if this site is a site that is not known, it will be by default opened using a virtual browser, and it's going to be a safe browser.
Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. This is really kind of an interesting discussion. It's cool to see the advancement in technology in this area. I do want to thank our guests for today for kind of dropping some knowledge on the Twilight. Mr. Danny Miller, from the Director of Product Marketing for Aircom Software, thank you so much for coming to the show. Really, really cool, interesting stuff. Can you tell the audience at home where they can find you, where they can find Aircom Software, where they can find your solutions, where they can get started?
Sure. So first of all, thanks for having me. You can find us on ericom.com or ericomshield.com. We have our offices in headquarters in New Jersey. We have office in England, although I'm not sure it's relevant for that particular audience, possible. We have an R&D center in Israel and some other development and support offices and a large network of security partners around the world. We'll be happy to hear from you. Drop us a note, and we'd love to talk to you and hear your security needs and help you join the isolation revolution.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Danny. That was Danny Miller from Aircom Software. Thank you so much for joining us and dropping some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour of the best dang enterprise show according to 9 out of 10 GZIP sites. But of course, I want to thank my co-host in crime, as well as our tireless producer of This Week in Enterprise Tech, Mr. Brian Chi Chibert. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find all your work, where they can find some of your fancy 3D printing doodads?
I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter, and I'd love to hear from you. If you feel more comfortable with email, I am also chibert@twit.tv. Pardon the squirrel cheeks. I've got a cough drop going. For some reason or another, my cough is going crazy, and probably because it's so hot. I especially want to say thank you to Daniel Miller from Aircom. It is past midnight in Tel Aviv, and I certainly appreciate you staying up late to talk to the Twilight Riot.
Thanks, Chibert. Well, folks, I also want to thank you. You tune in each and every week. We couldn't do this show without you. If you want continue to have your enterprise goodness week after week, we want you to subscribe. We want to make it easy for you to subscribe to This Week in Enterprise Tech. Just go out to the show page right now, twit.tv/Twilight. There you'll find all of our back episodes as well as full episode show notes, links to our stories, so on and so forth, especially information about our guests. More importantly, next to the videos, there's that magic button there to subscribe to a format of your choice, audio, video, HD video, and to any device of your choice, whether it's phone, tablet, desktop. Also, don't be afraid to share Twilight with your friends and family. We want you to learn about the tech world and the enterprise tech, so come out and subscribe. But also remember, we also do this show live each and every week at Friday, 1:30 Pacific time. And you can watch us show our live at live.twit.tv. And if you're going to watch us live, you might as well jump into the live chat room as well, irc.twit.tv. Each and every week, we get great discussions, great topics, great questions. In fact, this week, no exception to that. We had some amazing questions and great discussions in the chat room this week. So why don't you jump in and actually join that revolution there. Also, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/LouMM, where you can find out all the cool things that I'm working on. You can pitch show notes just as you can pitch to Chibert as well. So come out there and do that. Also, don't forget to visit graph.microsoft.io and dev.office.com to kind of see all of my work and things that are going on. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who support us each and every week for This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, thank you to all the engineers at Twit that make the show possible, as well as to our tireless producer, Chibert, even though he was kind of feeling under the weather this time. And, of course, to my TD, Kevin, Shark Man himself. Kevin, you can tell the folks at home, what is it that you do at Twit?
I make sure that all the tea bags are used to their fullest, so I keep refilling it until it tastes like nothing.
Well, you need somebody to take care of the tea bags, so that's fantastic. Well, folks, I hope you'll come back next week to This Week in Enterprise Tech. And, of course, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.